I'm John Schumann with Medical Matters. Coming up, an interview with Daniel Siegel, author of the new book Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. But first, Gary Schweitzer, publisher of healthnewsreview.org, is with us to review the week's health news. He's on the line from his home in St. Paul, Minnesota. How you doing, Gary?
I'm fine. Good to join you again.
Gary, I want to talk to you about this big story that made kind of a splash about mammography. This study was done in Canada. There was all kinds of news media coverage about this. Is mammography good? Is it something we have to do? Is mammography not something we should be doing now for women in their 40s? How do you read this?
Well, this was a long-term, 25-year follow-up of a Canadian national breast screening study. And in a nutshell, what it showed was that doing annual mammograms in women between 40 and 60 didn't reduce mortality, which is what you really care about. Now, in looking at news coverage, John, what drives me up the wall over and over and over again since the 90s, as I have followed this issue, is at every turn, with every new study and every new story, journalists and others tend to frame these mammography studies as conflicting and confusing and, oh, woe is us, and throw our hands up. What are we to do with this? And you know what? To that I say, it's confusing if you, the media messengers, make it that way. Do your job and cut through and evaluate the evidence. And I've seen bloggers who've done a good job of that. And they're not all, incidentally, journalists. Some of them are physicians who blog.
Who's good? Who's done a good job with this?
Otis Brawley, the chief medical officer of the American Cancer Society, on the CNN site, cut through this, I thought, very effectively, reminding people that no study is perfect. Each of them has flaws. But let's face it, folks, he wrote, these are the studies we have to make decisions from. So this is it, you know? And in essence, I think what he's saying is, what do you want to do? You want to throw up your hands and just continue to throw brickbats across the fence about the skeptics or the true believers? Or do you want to look at this? And as he wrote, sure, you can criticize some of the study design in this Canadian study, but he said there are huge inconsistencies in the studies that show a benefit from mammography. And one last thing I want to quote him on. He said, I'm concerned that we in American medicine have led many to believe that breast screening is better than it is. That's not to say it shouldn't be used. It should be used, but with caution. Now, why don't we frame things like that? And why don't we turn to people like Otis Brawley more often? You know, another blogger that I like, a guy named Aaron Carroll, who blogs on The Incidental Economist.
Yeah, he's
a really smart blog.
An economist, right?
Yeah, and he said, look, if you do 25-year follow-up, the technology at the start of the trial is always going to be older, always going to be outdated. So that was one of the criticisms of this trial. So if you started doing a study today and you did good long-term follow-up for 20 years, well, 20 years from now, by definition, the technology today is going to be outdated. So let's throw that out the window. That's back to what Brawley said. These are the studies we have to deal with. We have to grasp the fact that there is still uncertainty, but I think we've got to grasp the fact that this is not an issue for mandates. This is not an issue where we ought to be telling every woman she ought to be screened. I think there's an obligation to talk about what's now becoming more and more clear, that yes, there is some benefit, but yes, it is undeniable there is some harm.
And the harm comes from finding these very small tumors that aren't going to amount to anything, that then subject women to anxiety and further treatment with surgery and radiation. And in theory, if they could avoid all this without a mammogram that may or may not be necessary depending on their age and their risk factors.
Exactly. And if you look and if you are open-minded, you will find women who have had mammography and actually have regrets that they did. That doesn't mean that that is a belief that should influence other women, but women should know. This is not a slam dunk that all women ought to be screened. It can be a rational choice to say, I've looked at the evidence, I'm not convinced. And if you can't look at the evidence, and this can be difficult, then you need to find a doctor that can help you weigh the trade-offs of harms and benefits.
Okay, along those lines, There was a study last week that came out about thyroid cancer, a much less common type of cancer, but it appears from the literature and the statistics that we're seeing this rash, this epidemic of an increase in the amount of thyroid cancer. Why is that, and what's troubling about it?
Yeah, I think it's been a tripling, three times the number of thyroid cancers that have been found over a time 40 years ago. And what it is what we're finding, somewhat similar to the breast cancer story, is we're finding smaller tumors. We're finding some that are very common, but very slow growing. And so, same thing you just said, the more you look, the more you find. Once you find, you do something about it, you do more testing, which may carry its own complications and anxiety, treatment, which in the end might be for something that was not going to harm you. So this was a paper by Gil Welch of Dartmouth, who is a leading voice in this country on both overdiagnosis and overtreatment. And I just happened to last week hear a speech that he had given. It was captured on the web, and I was listening to it. And regarding thyroid cancer, he talked about one advocacy campaign that uses a slogan called Confidence Kills, that thyroid cancer can get any of us. So don't be smug and confident, because confidence kills. And Welch turned to the audience and he said, isn't that a great public health message? So if you're feeling okay, if you feel good about yourself, something is wrong with you.
Oh, my goodness.
And I think that's what happens sometimes with over-the-top advocacy for screening, is that we forget that we are turning healthy people into sick people, even though they may not be sick and often are not.
Okay, last story here. I saw something about pancreatic cancer awareness, where the marketing was essentially a patient who'd lost her hair saying, my cancer is worse than your cancer. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this was another over-the-top patient advocacy campaign. I'm sure it was well-intentioned. But this was on behalf of pancreatic cancer awareness. What happened with this campaign? Some people have referred to this over the years as disease Olympics. So here we are with the Olympics just ending. But we often have different advocacy campaigns competing for attention or for funding. And that's what it feels like happened here. So this was a pancreatic cancer awareness group. And in their ads, they had a woman with pancreatic cancer saying, I wish I had breast cancer. And they had a man with pancreatic cancer saying, I wish I had testicular cancer. So it's like, you know, my cancer is worse than your cancer. And this really sickened a lot of observers who looked at this, saying, could we please stop this? Cancer is not a competition. Whatever cancer they have, this is not a contest to see who's got it worse. But these campaigns and many of the media messages, as we've just talked about now, are really unhelpful. And that's why I think, John, that a program like yours is so important, to just get people to think about the trade-offs that are involved in both screening and in treatment. So these were three cancer topics that we talked about today. And I'm really concerned about the poor public dialogue that we have about cancer communication.
Well, Gary Schweitzer of healthnewsreview.org, moving us down the path toward more enlightenment in terms of making our medical choices. Thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you next week.
Look forward to it.
Gary Schweitzer, a longtime health journalist, runs the website healthnewsreview.org. You're listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Adolescence. Just saying the word brings back those awkward teenage years. The friends, the enemies, the Sturm und Drang. There aren't many of us that would want to go through it all again. As parents who deal with teenagers of our own, even the most sanguine of us can lose our cool. Our guest today, Daniel Siegel, is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine, where he's on the faculty of the Center for Culture, Brain, and Development and the founding co-director of the Mindful Awareness Research Center. His new book, Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain, radically reframes our notions of adolescence from the viewpoint of new understandings in brain development. It's a view that might surprise you. Dr. Daniel Siegel, welcome to Medical Matters.
Thank you, John. A pleasure to be here.
You know, the book basically makes the case that adolescence is a lot longer than maybe we thought it was. Have we redefined adolescence? I thought it kind of started at puberty and pretty much ended by the time you went to college. What's changed?
You know, that's exactly right. One of the things we used to believe is that the adolescent period, this time between childhood and adulthood, was really overlapping with the teenage years. And it turns out that once we've peered underneath the skull at the actual events going on in the brain, we've learned that there's a remodeling going on that lasts into the mid-20s. So the adolescent period begins a little bit before the teenage years usually, and it's not exactly the same as puberty, but it's roughly around that time. And then it ends in this remodeling period, it's ending around 24, 25 years of age.
So do you think that's the most surprising thing that readers of your book have kind of hit you with? Like, what do you mean adolescence goes till you're 24 or 25? Or do you think that people say, yeah, that's what I always thought, but now this kind of validates it?
You know, it's so interesting. It's kind of both those, John. One is they're shocked because everyone thinks the teenage years are the same as the adolescent years, and they're just not. Another shocker that gets actually people feeling comfortable is they realize this age of remodeling is not just a period of immaturity, which people used to call it. It's actually a time that we need to honor and actually cultivate. And that's another part that really shocks people. I think the third thing that really shocked everyone, including the scientists that found out about this and the physicians that really work with adolescents, is that there's this pruning that goes on that's a part of the remodeling of the brain that no one anticipated would be what was happening. So in general, you know, in childhood, you keep on accumulating these new neural connections, the synaptic connections, as you learn more and you lay down myelin as you're developing skills. And we thought that you just keep on doing that in adolescence. But once we started looking at the actual development of the brain across this period, we saw that in the beginning of adolescence, you start carving away neurons and their connections so that you actually have less neurons and less synaptic connections than you did in childhood. And then what you do is you start myelinating, you're laying down the myelin that's going to allow the remaining circuits to become 3,000 times quicker and more coordinated as you go through your development during this period. So ultimately, pruning, the carving away of neurons and their connections, myelinating, increasing in the effective connectivity of these remaining neurons, really allows the brain to become more integrated, and that's ultimately what the remodeling is all about. And it takes about the second dozen years of life to let that remodeling complete.
Oh, there's just so many questions that I have about that. But well, let's start just broadly. So you, as you said, one of the most surprising things I think in your writing and what people have reacted to is framing adolescence in this very positive light. You know, you're calling adolescence the power and purpose of the teenage brain, or that's the tagline for the book. Is this wishful thinking, or is it a real sea change in parenting and how we approach adolescence?
I think this is actually a real change in how we can approach adolescence, and it is a sea change. It's a fundamental shift in our understanding of what the adolescent period is about because of science. You know, because technology is advanced and we've been able to systematically study adolescents as they've gone through this period of time. We've learned about the pruning that goes on and the myelination that goes on. That's a remodeling that we never understood was happening before. And in addition, we've learned other things, that there are changes in the reward circuitry of the brain with drops in dopamine levels at baseline and increases in release levels, and also even changes in the way the evaluative circuits of the brain really judge how to make a decision. So instead of thinking of it as impulsivity, which happens in the early part of the adolescent period, it's actually changing the focus on the exciting, thrilling upside of a choice, and knowing about the downside, but decreasing a focus on those sides. Now, you can say, well, hold on, why do these changes happen? And this is the real conceptual change for all of us as parents and as adolescents, is that there is a purpose to each of these changes, and there's a power to them too. And in the past, we've had attitudes like, well, adolescents are just immature, and they just have to grow up, or, hey, they've got raging hormones that are driving them mad, so don't pay any attention to them, or, you know, things like this. The problem with those statements, first of all, is that they're wrong. Secondly, they're not only misleading us, but they're leading us to behave in ways that are disempowering, both for adolescents and adults. Because let's take the raging hormone belief. If you think, as an adolescent, that your hormones are inside of you raging, and now while it is true they rise because of puberty, but I don't know exactly what a raging hormone looks like, if it's like screaming at you or what it's doing. If you believe that, there's nothing you can do. Like, what are you supposed to do, take an anti-raging hormone pill? Or, like, what are you supposed to do with raging hormones? However, when we understand it's the brain, we now know that you can do something with your mind to actually change the function and structure of your brain. We used to wonder about that about a decade ago, but now we have the empirical evidence to show that it's actually true. How you focus your attention in a systematic way can lead to activation in the brain that over time can lead to structural changes in the brain itself. So when you realize that nature has created this remodeling period that is not a period of immaturity, this other myth, and it's a period of transformation. What do I mean by that? I mean that the changes in your evaluative circuits and your dopamine reward circuits, the pruning that goes on, the remodeling, it's not that just you're waiting to become something else, that is, you're immature, waiting to mature. These changes in the brain are fundamentally allowing you as a child to move toward adulthood by pushing away from the home nest and getting ready to leave the familiar, certain, comfortable, safe environment of the home to go to what's unfamiliar, what's uncertain, what can be uncomfortable, and really what's full of potential unsafety, that is danger. And when you do that, you have to say, well, how am I going to do this? I'm a kid. I'm at home. I like being at home. It's comfortable. The only way you're not going to have your kid at home, I tell parents, when they're 40 or 50 years old, is if you let nature do its course of having this purpose and this power to allow this individual to go towards what's uncertain and unsafe, to take risks, because that's the only way you're going to get this kid out of the house. Now, once you see that, then you understand that there's a fundamental essence to adolescence that I talk about in the book, which is fascinating because it isn't a period of immaturity. It's a necessary period of transformation. That's number one. And this essence is actually a set of features that the remodeling brain has. And when you cultivate them well, your adolescence can actually do well. And so here's the beautiful thing. You can do something as an adolescent or an adult supporting an adolescent to get the brain to grow in particular ways. You really can. And now we have the exercises to do that. I call them mindset exercises. They're based on empirically proven studies that show you can help the brain develop in an integrative way by what you do with your mind. But then the other thing is you can say, well, as I move my development forward, should I just get rid of this essence of adolescence? And when we review them, John, we can see the studies of adult neuroplasticity suggest that there's an essence that we start with in adolescence that if we hold on to it in adulthood, it's the exact features we need to keep our brains growing well throughout the lifespan.
To be generative, as it were, in adulthood and continue learning as we go forward.
To learn, to be generative, and actually to literally keep neuroplasticity going well.
Okay, I want to come back to that in a second. You're listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Our guest today is Daniel Siegel, who's a clinical professor of psychiatry at UCLA and author of the newly released bestseller, Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain, what he calls an inside-out guide to the emerging adolescent mind, ages 12 to 24. One of the themes that you employ throughout the book is mindsight, which you mentioned, and it's actually the title of one of your previous books. Tell us what you mean by that concept and, you know, how it can basically help adolescents and their parents work together.
Well, John, when I was in medical school back in 1978, it was a painful experience for me because a number of my professors at school didn't see the mind of their patients. So if they were struggling with some illness or being given a diagnosis of a terminal illness, for example, my professors would go in the room, give them the diagnosis, and walk out. And they wouldn't tell them about how they might best deal with this stress. They didn't ask them how they were feeling. They didn't offer supportive comments. It was kind of shocking to me. So ultimately, I dropped out of school because I didn't really feel I wanted to become that kind of professional. And when I spent my year away and decided ultimately to come back, I made up this word called mindsight, which to me meant seeing the mind of oneself for insight and seeing the mind of another person for empathy. And when I went back to school, you know, the teachers were still how they were, and I tried to remind myself that some teachers had mindsight and some didn't, and I didn't want to become like the ones who lacked this, what seemed to me, crucial human ability. Now, that was 1980, 81, and since then, there's been a whole science around the ability to reflect on one's own internal life and to reflect on the internal life of someone else, to have insight and empathy. We've seen this in medical practice where even in the visit of someone for a common cold, if empathic communication is a part of that 10-minute visit, people have an improved immune function and get over the cold a day sooner. We've seen this even in the physicians themselves, in primary care physicians who are taught to reflect in a mindful way on their own internal life. They maintain empathy in their practice, and they reduce massively burnout. And so reflection becomes a really important thing. So mindsight is a broad term which involves a lot of different things, insight, empathy, and something I call integration. Mindful awareness would be included under mindsight. But what I wanted to do is include skill-building exercises that build mindsight for the adolescent so that they can actually reduce stress, improve their ability to focus attention, regulate their emotions with more balance, and have more empathy, all of which can, you know, help their life as they go through this challenging period of time. And so mindsight became this kind of organizing set of exercises. And the fun thing about it from a brain point of view is all the studies of things related to mindsight, insight, empathy, are related to what's called integration in the brain. Integration is where you link differentiated parts. And what's really central about integration in the brain is whenever you hear someone say, I want to have the ability to regulate my attention or regulate my emotion, the word regulation is implying a function that emerges from a structural capacity for integration, that you're coordinating and balancing a system. And that integrative capacity is the basis of self-regulation. So any way we can promote integration, we're going to be promoting health in a person's life.
So is mindsight then a practice or a characteristic or both? And in order to have it, does one have to be both insightful and empathic, or it's not an either-or necessarily, but...
Well, that's a really interesting question, John. As a practice, when you learn to be reflective inside yourself, it often builds the same circuitry in the brain that you use to be empathic. It's really fascinating, the overlap, brain-wise, of insight and empathy. I think in actual experience, you can have some people who are very empathic who don't have much insight into themselves, and some people are very self-aware, maybe not in an open way, and they aren't so empathic. So you see all sorts of combinations of just what you're asking. And then the question about is it a process or is it just a fundamental concept, you know, I think it's a learnable process that kids learn in homes, and there are fascinating studies to show what you need to develop this ability. But everyone, for the most part, has a birthright to have this capacity, and I think it's the central part of relationships, whether it's between a physician and a patient or between colleagues or, you know, with spouses or parents and children. I think it's the fundamental process that helps us have really supportive relationships. Dan Goleman, who wrote a book called Emotional Intelligence and a book called Social Intelligence, he believes that mindsight is the mechanism that's beneath emotional and social intelligence.
I believe that. I do. Explain a little further, if you can, about what you mean by integration then, because that's the tying it together, or that's the synthesis that provides sort of the better wholeness.
Yeah, I think those two go together. For me, you know, when I was in medical school, I was always, you know, wondering about how our minds and our subjective experience that's in our minds and our consciousness, how that related to what happened in our bodies. So as physicians, you know, we're trained in the science of the body and healing the body. And then I noticed when I was in college, I'd worked on a suicide prevention service, and, you know, I was taught that how you communicate in a relationship on the phone during a crisis could make the difference between whether someone chose to live or chose to die. And so through medical school, I was always interested in the relationship between the physician and the patient, and being trained in the body, of course, I was wondering how does a relationship connect to body functions like physiological functions and biochemical functions. And then as time went on, when I went into pediatrics and then moved over to psychiatry and then became a researcher in relationships in psychiatry, it was right around the beginning of the decade of the brain, and I was really curious to see if we could tie these three things together, the mind, the brain, and the whole body, and relationships, you know, how we communicate with each other. So over these decades now, I've been trying to put together this field called interpersonal neurobiology, where we take all the different disciplines of science and we combine them into one framework. So I've edited about 36 textbooks for professionals in interpersonal neurobiology that have overseen the publication of these. And what came out of all that synthesis of science was a kind of simple statement, which is we have a kind of a definition of mind we use, but in terms of the integration question, we see integration, which is defined very simply as the linkage of differentiated parts of a system. So like in a brain, it might be the left and right side or the cortex and the lower limbic and brainstem areas. In a relationship, it might be how a patient and a physician communicate with each other, where they honor differences and promote compassionate communication between the two of them. That would be an integrated relationship. So you could look at this linkage of differentiated parts as a process. And then when it came to making statements like integration is health, there was a whole science behind that which said that when a system is functioning in an integrated way, it basically functions with harmony. It has the features of being flexible and adaptive. It's what mathematicians would call coherent. It holds together well over time, and it's energized and stable. This movement, which spells the word FACES, I'm an acronym nut, you know, this FACES flow actually allows you to follow the functioning of the system over time, which has an integrated well-being to it. Now, this becomes really interesting because when a system is not integrated, either differentiation is blocked or a linkage is blocked, you move away from harmony. It's like a river. The river, let's say the river is harmony. One bank outside the river is chaos. The other bank is rigidity. And as a psychiatrist, when I turn to our, you know, American Psychiatric Association's DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, for me, every symptom of every syndrome of that book revealed chaos or rigidity. And that reflected my experience with the patients I was seeing. And then with the proposal, you could say, well, if integration is the function that allows for well-being, can you actually show anatomically that it's not only a function, but it's an anatomical reality? And then it turns out you can, so that in certain disorders which have been looked at, such as autism, there's impaired differentiation and therefore impaired integration. In schizophrenia, for example, with individuals with that disorder, there's impaired linkage, again, impairing integration. With manic depressive illness, impaired integration because there's impaired linkage. And those are non-experientially caused. If you turn to the experientially caused disorders like severe trauma in the form of abuse or neglect, Marty Teicher at Harvard University has shown that the integrative fibers of the brain are blocked either in their growth or they're actually damaged. And these are the hippocampus that connects widely separated memory regions together, the corpus callosum, which connects the left and right hemisphere to each other, or the prefrontal region, which connects the cortex, the limbic area, the brainstem, the body proper, and even signals from other brains, the social world. So these major integrative areas are not developing well with trauma. Overall, what this says is that most of the notions about integration, whether it's functional, as looking at the outcome of it, or anatomical, in these cases I'm describing, there's supportive evidence now to suggest, not to prove, but to suggest, in fact, that the hypothesis is accurate, that integration is the basis of health, and impaired integration leads to unhealth. And this has a connection to adolescence we can talk about, but that's like the fastest summary of the whole field of interpersonal neurobiology and the role of integration.
Well, that was really quite fascinating. I wasn't actually expecting to get to that today, but that was really... So one thing that really surprises me, or I think is kind of fascinating, is you sort of alluded to this, but the language of mathematics that's involved in that, right? So you talk about differentiation and integration, which are sort of the functions of calculus. So I think just that language is quite interesting, and when you apply it to brain science and mathematics, it all sounds very intelligent. So I want to...
Let me just say one thing about that for the mathematicians who are listening. in math, the kind of linkage of differentiated parts I'm talking about, they would never call integration, because for a mathematician, they're using the term integration as addition. But in the common everyday use of the word integration, how I'm using it, even though it's drawing on the mathematical principles of what's called complexity theory to look at complex systems, here it is the linkage of differentiated parts, absolutely. But they would never use the word integration, because I've spent a lot of time with mathematicians talking about this. Here you need to have the different parts retain their differentiated nature and become linked. With the integration in calculus, you actually are blending them, and you don't care how you got there. You just arrived at the addition. It's the summation. So you know the statement, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts?
Sure.
This is what we mean by integration in the way I'm using it. For a mathematician, actually, the whole is the sum of its parts when they use the word integration. So this is where you just want to make sure you know, in general, how we're using these terms. Now, the cool thing is, here's what the scientists who are doing the really hard empirical work at UCLA and at the National Institute of Mental Health, you know, to discover this remodeling in the brain, here's what they say. The goal of remodeling, in addition to these fundamental things that adolescence allows us to move away and push against the status quo and all this stuff, the neural goal of it is to increase integration. So what I said when I was writing the book for adolescents and adults, I said, okay, well, why don't we then offer adolescents effective, empirically established ideas where you can use your mind to produce more integration in the brain to help them actually during this time of remodeling, which is moving their brains in general toward integration, to allow them to enhance the integration that can happen. And that's the exciting thing about these exercises, these mindset exercises, is it gives an adolescent a tool to actually do something about what's going on with their brains. And that's the exciting thing about, you know, seeing how adolescents are going to take this, because it empowers them in some really, really important ways.
You're listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Our guest today, Dr. Daniel Siegel, a clinical professor of psychiatry at UCLA and author of Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain, an inside-out guide to the emerging adolescent mind, ages 12 to 24. And we've been talking a lot about anatomy, actually, and you mentioned some parts of the brain. And I thought, since most folks, as smart as they are in our listening audience, don't necessarily know a lot of brain anatomy, in the book you include a handy model of the brain, which I hadn't seen before, using your own hand. And
yeah.
Given the limitation of radio, if you could at least try to link the parts of the hand in the model that you propose and, you know, which parts of the brain they link to, I think those of us listening could just do the mental imagery.
Sure. Well, certainly if you're not driving and listening to this, you can take your hand and put your thumb in the middle and swing it over your fingers, swing them over the top. And if you are driving, do this later and just imagine this. You know, you have your knuckles now facing you. That would be the face of this person. And if you turn your hand to the side and sort of look at the side, we're going to look at the three major areas of the brain. Lifting up your fingers and lifting up your thumb, we've got these three major parts. And we'll start with the spinal cord, which is represented in the wrist, which brings up data and information and energy flow from the body. There's other areas like the 10th cranial nerve, the vagus nerve that does that too. But the first area that this information tends to go to is the brain stem. And the brain stem would be in your palm, and it's the most ancient part of the brain. It's called the reptilian brain, 300 million years old. It governs all sorts of things, including, you know, how your heart is working, how your intestines are working. And it also includes clusters of neurons, nuclei, that are involved in the fight, flight, freeze, and faint response. Those are very much integrated with the higher area just above it. If you put down your thumb, you'd have two thumbs to be a perfect model, left and right. And this is your limbic area. It developed when we became mammals about 200 million years ago. And it has a number of different functions, including, you know, helping to generate emotion with the body's processing and the brainstem and the limbic area working together in that arena of emotion. It motivates us with the brainstem. It works together to motivate us to behave in certain ways. It has, the third thing is it has appraisal centers that literally evaluate whether something's worth paying attention or not, and if we pay attention to it, is it good or bad? These are the basic evaluative circuits of the brain. And then it has the hippocampus, which helps distinguish different kinds of memory. It takes what's called implicit memory that's embedded all around the brain, and it actually weaves that together. It integrates that literally into explicit forms of factual memory and autobiographical memory. And then finally, the fifth major function in the limbic region that is dominant there is attachment. Attachment is basically our mammalian heritage to rely on attachment figures, usually our parents, to care for us, to protect us, to see us, to soothe us when we're upset. And this attachment pattern is important because in adolescence, this limbic function changes. We want to move toward our peers more than our parents. And that becomes a very important function. Even the evaluative circuits in the brain start changing. So we focus on the thrilling part of a choice. There's a circuit we haven't talked about here that influences that too. It's the reward circuit with the dopamine changes that gets us to drive for novelty because there's drops in the baseline dopamine levels and elevations in the release level. And even the lower areas, you know, where we're more emotional, we can see in the adolescent brain there's more of an input from these lower structures to the one we're about to talk about, the cortex, so that our thinking and reasoning is influenced more by emotions during the adolescent period. And that has a downside, of course. You can be irritable and moody and not rely on your own, you know, emotional state. But the upside is life is full of passion and vitality. I call that an emotional spark. So the final area is your, if you put your fingers over the top, this is your cortex, just like the limbic area. There's a left and right, and there's a corpus callosum that I mentioned earlier that connects the two. This area is basically an area which is six cells deep. So in most of it, it's got these columns of six cells up and down. And what these columns do, we believe, is they make maps of things. So in the back of your brain, you're mapping out the three-dimensional world that we usually pick up through our eyes. But if we're blind, we pick it up with our fingers and our touch. Side of the brain is for picking up sound. The higher part, the parietal lobe, you know, can pick up where we're touching things with our skin. And, you know, the front part, this is from your second to the last knuckles, four, that's the frontal lobe, most elaborate in human beings. And the frontmost part of that is really elaborate in humans. It's called the prefrontal cortex. And in general, this frontal area is where you have concepts, you have reasoning, you have thinking. It's the associational cortex where you're making associations among different things that you've experienced and you put together in memory. And the prefrontal cortex, for those of you who are not driving, you can see if you lift up your fingers and put them back down, these middle two fingernail areas especially, anatomically what's unique about the prefrontal region is that it connects the cortex, the limbic area, the brainstem, you can see that right in your hand model, and input from the body, as well as input from other brains, you know, other signals that come in. So it's the social world, the somatic world, the brainstem, the limbic area, and the cortex, five relatively distinct sources of energy and information flow, electrochemical energy transformations in the body, signals you get from others in the form of sound or light. That's the energy we're talking about, not something mystical. I mean, it's fantastical, but it's not mystical. It's just real science. And these energy patterns are either shared socially or we pick them up through the body, and the prefrontal region coordinates them. So when we hear from Marty Teicher at Harvard that what is impaired after trauma are these three major integrative areas, the corpus callosum that connects left and right, the hippocampus that allows us to make explicit memories, and the prefrontal region that links the whole thing together, cortex, limbic area, brainstem, body, social world. We know that integration is the basis of all regulation, regulating attention, emotion, thought, behavior, interpersonal relationships. So when we say integration is impaired, what we mean is there's going to be a challenge to how you can regulate yourself, which is the basis of all psychiatric conditions. And then what you say is, well, wow, maybe I could create some interventions, which is what I've been doing these last few decades, that actually try to cultivate integration in the brain. And if I did that, maybe people would be empowered to get better, because now we know what you do with your mind can change the function of the brain in the moment. And over time, when you get these neurons to fire in specific kinds of ways, you get them to rewire. And if we can get that rewiring to be toward integration, this is where you can use the mind to actually change the structure of the brain to improve its regulatory abilities.
It's amazing. And it's one of the things I really like best about the book is that it's kind of this two-in-one. I mean, it's really a lot of this science, but written at a level that, you know, pretty much an intelligent person can understand. You do not need a medical degree or a PhD to understand this and about brain development, but also the how-to part, right? So, I mean, you're telling us, the readers, about MindSight and really practices therein that can, you said it best, really can almost reshape the structure of our brains. And so I just want to point out that the example you gave was a semester's worth of neuroanatomy in less than 5 minutes. That was incredible.
It's what's really fun about the MoMeRet, I think, in medicine is, well, especially, you know, when we're looking at this wonderful thing about connecting relationships and the brain and the body and the mind all into one thing, is we can make it accessible for the general public, you know. And so what I find so rewarding is the idea we can empower the average citizen. And in this case, you know, when I wrote the Brainstorm book, I wanted to write it for adolescents to read, because there's nothing available to them for them to read about their own developmental period and their own brain, really. And when I've been going around to schools, it's kind of amazing, although I guess I shouldn't be that surprised, but virtually all the adolescents I've been teaching lately in this school since the book came out have said they've heard nothing from anyone about what's going on in their brains. No teachers, no parents, nobody says anything. And so what would be really beautiful is if we can empower people with this medical knowledge, if we can empower the adolescents, you know, their teachers, their parents, what could be fantastic is to really give people an understanding of the truth, not the myths, empower them with the idea that this is a period not of immaturity, but actually of incredible possibility, to really see there is, in fact, a power and a purpose. It's not just a subtitle to a book. It's actually an invitation to take on this period of life, whether you're an adult or an adolescent in it, and make the best of it. The thing that really amazed me when I was writing it was to come across this essence of adolescence, the four major aspects of understanding the remodeling adolescent brain. You know, this spell, I'm an acronym person, so it spells the word essence itself. ES is emotional spark. As I mentioned, the emotions rise up in the cortex more. SE is social engagement. The limbic area changes, so you want to engage with your peers more than your parents, and that's for survival value. And then there's a N, it's the movement toward novelty, which this dopamine change and the reward circuitry really pushes adolescents to try new things. And CE of essence is creative exploration. It's challenging your mind. And in this case, you know, we have as adolescents this push against the adult status quo to look at the world in new ways. And, you know, the downside of that is it can be disorienting. You know, when you're a kid, you just accept what adults say. Now you're an adolescent. There's this natural thing to question everything. Now adults, you know, with adolescents can feel rejected or upset or say they're rebellious or they're having problems or whatever. But in fact, it's in our evolutionary history to have an adolescent push against the status quo. The upside is that, you know, in our major fields like art and music, science, technology, for the most part, the majority of the innovations that have happened in those fields have come from adolescent minds. Keep in mind, it's the second dozen years of life into the mid-20s. And when you realize that, and then even realize that the world is forever changing, and we adults know we get kind of settled into our ways, we've learned how to deal with things, we're kind of tired, we just want to go home, and the world is forever changing, we need some aspect of our human family. I think it's the adolescents who come along and they're able to adapt to the ever-changing world, because as adults, you know, we get used to the status quo and we just want things to stay the way they are. But, you know, the world is always changing. So without adolescents, we wouldn't be able to adapt. And I think the reason why human beings as a species have been able to live in every aspect of our planet is because of the courage and creativity of adolescents. So not only do they contribute in innovative ways to all these fields, they allow us as a human family to adapt. The final thing I'll just say is that when you think about the essence of adolescence, the emotional spark, the social engagement, the novelty, the creative exploration, if you had to pick the top four empirically established ways in which we as adults can keep our brains growing well and staying strong throughout our lifespan, it would actually be these four features. Keep passion in your life with an emotional spark. Keep important social networks of support involved in your whole life. This is something that's true across the lifespan, the social engagement. Keep novelty going. Try new things. Keep yourself challenged in all sorts of ways. And for creative exploration, keep on moving the envelope out of your comfort zone. Try challenging your mind in new ways. These are the ways you keep your brain young. So amazingly, the myth that adolescence is a period of immaturity is not only wrong, it's a period we can actually cultivate well with this essence during adolescence And then we need to hold on to it in adulthood if we want to live a vital life and keep our brains young and strong.
I think that's indeed a novel message, because so often we're trying to forget those awkward teenage years, you know, so this is really a dramatic reshaping the way we think it. Dr. Daniel Siegel, I really want to thank you for your time, and congratulations on the book. It really is a remarkable sort of two-in-one in terms of exercises to keep the brain plastic, help with emotional connections between parents and adolescents, and also gives this amazing background in neuroscience that I think is extremely educational.
John, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on board.
Daniel Siegel is a psychiatrist at the UCLA School of Medicine. His new book is called Brainstorm. I'm John Schumann, and you're listening to Medical Matters, a program about health, healthcare, and the human condition. One of the developmental tasks that's important for all of us, teenagers and otherwise, is being able to apologize. It turns out that for medical students, the phrase "I'm sorry" has extraordinary value. Harvard medical student Sherry Yerkowitz shares her thoughts in this personal essay.
He was a frail and tremulous man, and I walked into his hospital room to do his physical exam. He immediately demanded that I get him food. I explained that he couldn't eat yet because he was at risk for swallowing the wrong way and having the food go into his lungs and cause an infection. "You effing bee," the new patient yelled, as loudly as he could with his weakened voice. I apologized, while he responded with hatred in his voice, "You're not sorry." As the patient called me creative names and instructed me to do creative deeds, my sympathetic system took over. My cheeks flushed, my heart pounded, and I felt the overwhelming urge to flee. At first, I felt sorry that the patient was hungry and couldn't eat. I felt sorry that he didn't deserve the medical hand he had been dealt. After several minutes, though, my empathy faltered and gave out. My thoughts turned from the patient's plight to a more inward stance. "I don't deserve this." That single thought amplified until the hungry patient in front of me no longer existed. "I don't deserve this." I knew it wasn't personal, because he would have screamed at anyone who happened to stand in my place. But at the same time, it was personal, because it was me. I didn't say much and walked out, feeling shaky. More disturbing thoughts snaked their way into my consciousness and wouldn't let go. No, I wasn't sorry anymore. No, I didn't really care what happened to him. And then the most toxic thought of them all. In that moment, I didn't care if he lived or died. With that realization, I found a bathroom to cry in for about half an hour, while I ignored the page from my resident inviting me to get lunch. Within an hour, my limbic brain had yielded to my cortex. Ironically, it was analysis, rather than raw emotion, that brought back empathy. I reread the patient's notes, talked to his son, and felt as though I had a better grasp on the reasons behind his intense anger. Within a few hours, he was transferred to the ICU. Half of me felt sorry, but the other half felt relieved that I wouldn't have to see him again. During our psychiatry rotation, we had a lecture on how to think about difficult patients. We were encouraged to think about the feelings of helplessness, uncertainty, anxiety, and fear patients felt, in addition to the destructive medical processes impairing their minds and bodies. We were told never to forget that context when we dealt with someone whose behavior didn't conform to our expectations of how a good patient should act. It was a valuable lecture, and I sat in the safety of our conference room absorbing it. On the floor, feeling vulnerable and helpless, I lost sight of that lecture. I was feeling the same things my patient most likely felt. yet to a fraction of that extent. Although I didn't verbally abuse anyone the way he did, my internal verbalizations seemed a fair match. Destruction need not be loud, and it need not be an action. Perhaps it begins with a thought, one that snakes into your consciousness and amplifies. Perhaps it ends in inaction, with your walking out of the room too early. Before I wrote this essay, I checked on that patient's status. He had passed away a few weeks after our encounter. I wonder if I had known how close he was to death, if my thoughts would have changed in that moment when our lives intersected. I also know that the answer shouldn't matter. Here's to the start of being the bad guy with good intentions. Here's to the start of trying harder, of keeping those good intentions during the most difficult moments, those when no one else believes you have them.
Shara Yerkowitz is a fourth-year medical student at Harvard. You've been listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Our program is recorded in the studios of KWGS, Public Radio of Tulsa, at the University of Tulsa. Medical Matters is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. Our theme music is by Europa 51, original music by Scott Griffith. Join us next week when the subject is aging in America and we speak to a geriatrician using technology to improve her practice and the lives of caregivers. For more information on Medical Matters, check out our blog, glasshospital.com, or email us at glasshospital@gmail.com.